We speak about the world, the flesh, and the devil as the enemies of the Christian life. Do you know that these are not three different things? All of these operate on only one principle, the self. The world operates on the principle of self. The flesh is what motivates us in the self to do what my flesh wants me to do. And the devil, of course, is always motivated by self. Why do you listen to God? Do what you like. You do not stand on the side of God, but you stand on the side of men. What do you mean by men? Men, in the sense of unregenerate man, is always motivated by self. Why do Christians fall? Self. Why do young people, say, fall into sexual sins? Well, the answer is plain. You have not been able to deny yourself. Therefore, you go and do these things. And then afterwards, you're sorry about it. You regret it. But you've already done it. Why have you not denied self? Do you understand that when you do these things and you haven't denied self, you cannot be a disciple of the Lord? That's what he said. That's not what I said. He said this. Now, let's look at the world. The world functions entirely on the principle of self. When we say that we must not love the world, of course we love the world if we love ourselves. There's no way there's any difference. The world functions on the basis of the self. The whole society in which we live functions on the principle of self-interest. If you took away this principle from the world, the whole society of this world would collapse because it hasn't got another principle to function on. This whole society works on this principle. You look at all the advertisements that you see around. You cannot be, you know, it wouldn't take you long immediately to discern that the whole society works on self. You buy a new car, you know. Now, how does the car advertise itself? Well, the car tells you, if you look at the advertisements and study them, they're very revealing. One advertisement says, for example, I was looking at an advertisement for car stereos. The thing is, it's too funny, it's, you know, too ridiculous to look at. And it says, you know, it's showing, as you may have seen, that usually comes before, immediately after the news, this kind of advertisements. And what you see there, you see a very attractive girl who is a waitress serving at the takeout store or something like this. And then she goes, who does she serve? It says she serves the guy in a particular car. She ignores all these other cars parked there, and she serves the guy in one particular car. And so the advertisement says, why is she doing this? Why does she serve this guy in this car? Is it because he drives a very magnificent car? And then you see that it's a Mini. So is it because this guy is dressed in the latest style suit? You see, he wears a very ordinary suit. Now, is this guy a very handsome guy? No, he's only a middle-aged, balding fellow. Competing with me, you see. So, it leads to the question, why is she ignoring all these handsome guys sitting in these beautiful cars around there and coming to this Mini with this middle-aged, the bald-headed fellow sitting in a rather ordinary suit in this little yellow Mini? Well, and the answer, of course, is because of his car stereo. Oh, boy. This is advertisement for you. This is how to advertise a car stereo, you see. It draws this attractive waitress to your car to serve you, you see. How ridiculous. But you see, it plays on all the elements of self. The desire for attention, particularly the attention of a very attractive girl, of course. And the desire for food, that she not only brings herself, but the food along too. And she, moreover, ignores the entire crowd, and you are the one that she pays attention to. Therefore, get this car stereo. It's incredible. The appeal to self and the lowest elements in self are always there. You can just study any of these advertisements and look at it for yourself. Well, there's the advertisement of a car, isn't it? And what happens? You see this guy coming up. And this car, of course, is parked outside the Hilton very significantly because you see a little neon sign which says Hilton, you see. And what is the significance of Hilton got to do with this car? Well, the idea is, of course, to suggest to you that people who drive this kind of car go to the Hilton. So if you drive this kind of car, you will be in the class of the people who go to Hilton. Or you see a watch, who is wearing this? Oh, some well-known sports personality, maybe Muhammad Ali Muhammad, what is his name? So, you see, and there he is wearing this watch. So what is the idea? The idea is, of course, that what's he got to do with the watch? Well, the idea is that, of course, if you wear this kind of watch, you will be in the class of people like Ali. Well, if you don't happen to be interested in boxing, well, they got somebody else that suits your tastes, see. Well, if you like hotel management, and there is this great guy who is the boss of the whole chain of hotels around the world, and what is he doing? There's a photograph of him sitting there, and his watch is shining in your face, and that is the watch that he is wearing. You see, this is the appeal to self. The irrelevance of all this hardly strikes you, because you might suggest that another owner of another chain of great restaurants, in fact, wears the cheapest watch in the world, but that, of course, is not advertised. Yes. So all the time, these are the things that are being hinted at you, the appeal to self. This whole society is built in this kind of way. Oh, yeah, the Royal Bank was running a series of advertisements, very interesting, I think. We succeed when you succeed. I'm sure you heard this one from the Royal Bank. Oh, this one is really absolutely honest about their selfish motive. Why do we want you to succeed? Because we succeed when you succeed. So, of course, we don't want you to fail, because if you fail, then we don't succeed. Because when you fail, you've got no money to put in the bank. So we hope that you succeed, you put more money in our bank. Oh, that is as honest as you can get about the self-centered interest. Now, if my business would prosper through your failure, then I suppose the Royal Bank will say, I hope you fail so that we succeed. But since in this case they are rather interested that you succeed so that they can get more money out of you, then of course we succeed when you succeed. So this whole society, and Steinberg of course is on your side, especially on the side of your first, of course. Steinberg is on your side. And the most remarkable thing is that if you want to motivate a worldly man to be moral, you have to appeal to his selfishness. Otherwise, even his morality will not function. The morality of this world, and there is a morality in the world, the worldly morality is also built on selfishness. Oh, that's remarkable, isn't it? You can even persuade people to be moral by being selfish. For example, honesty is the best policy. What does that mean? Well, if you're honest, then you stay out of trouble. So that's the best policy. I mean, if you're not honest, you might end up in jail. And that's not a very good policy. So the way to stay out of jail is to be honest. Appeals again to the self in order even to be honest. Or you scratch my back and I'll scratch your back. And the reason I scratch your back is so that I have somebody to scratch my back. So the reason that I'm doing this for you is perfectly purely out of self-interest. I am kind to you so that you'll be kind to me, you see. If I'm not sure you're going to be kind to me, then I won't be kind to you, you see. So let's agree first. If I scratch your back, you remember to scratch my back, okay? So in this way, we have a morality, a concern for others, which is based out of self-interest. I'm going to help you now when you're in trouble, so that when I'm in trouble, you remember to help me. This is the natural man, of course. It's very reasonable on the logic of the self. I don't want to give you something if I don't get something back. If I give you something, you remember, last time I gave you was about $5 worth, the next time make it $5.50 because of inflation when you give buy something for me. Otherwise, I'm going to lose out on this exchange. We got to be fair. So, this is the whole logic of the carnal man. The natural man, even in his being good, if you can call it good, is motivated by selfishness. If this guy breaks down, I help him to repair his car in the hope the next time when I break down, he'll help me to repair my car. I mean, this is a very understandable. So you say, worldly people are so nice. Of course they are so nice. They want to get something out of you. No problem. Now, sometimes, of course, worldly people can be nice simply because it feels good to be nice. Yeah. As I always like to say, you know, when you give some, put a few coins in the hat of a beggar, it suddenly makes you feel so good. It's even, the beggar can't give you anything back. You already, how good you feel is more than sufficient reward. I mean, only put the dollar there, but oh, the good feeling for $1 is worth every bit of it. Right? So even there, or maybe you did something wrong, and by doing a bit of good, it helps to improve your conscience, you see. I did some wrong here, so I balance it out by doing some good on the other side. Even her morality is motivated entirely by the feeling within, the self-interest within. That is the natural man. So this is the nature of our society in which we live. That is why I said the world is motivated by self. That the flesh is motivated by self requires no explanation. That the devil is motivated by self, we also know already. That is why he tried to take the place of God. He wants to be number one, and of course the self always wants to be number one. And as every psychologist knows, the way to get somebody else to do something is to make him feel that he is going to be good as a result of doing that something. You will become number one if you wear the suit that I make. And you come to our shop and you put on this suit, you will really be number one. You will be something. You will be like the Prince of Monaco. Now all of this, we must understand then, we are not facing a multitude of enemies. We are facing one enemy. It's not the world is some kind of enemy and flesh is another. This is simply self functioning in different spheres. The enemy is always the same. We are our greatest enemy when it comes to spiritual life and spiritual reality. Now, the question then is, how do we know whether we are delivered from the self or not? And speaking, I should think mostly to people who are Christians, who consider themselves to be disciples. Yet I find it alarming that among people who think that they have already disposed of the self, one sees everywhere the marks of the self. Well, what are the marks of the self? Let us examine our own thinking, for example. We just saw that it says that carnal man seeks to gain the world. But let's look at ourselves. You're given a promotion in your company. Oh, how good it feels. This is something really great. Suddenly you feel yourself 6 feet high. Or, what are the things that give you pleasure? Does the applause or the praise of man really make you high? I wonder. When people praise you and say something good about you and it makes you feel so great, you should be careful about that. Because if praise has that kind of effect upon you, the chances are that yourself is very far from having been denied. Very far from having been denied. Or, do the things of this present age matter more to you than the things which are eternal? Or are they equally important? Do they bring equal excitement to you? Signs of danger there, the marks of the carnal man. What about the struggle with pride? Pride of life. The Apostle John speaks about that in 1 John. He says, these are the things, the pride of life, the lust of the eyes. These are the marks of the carnal man. So, I find even in conversation sometimes with Christians, the things that they gloat about, you see everywhere, the self has not been denied. Another sign of self, of course, is in individualism. Particularly painful to me often is to see, for example, at times in the training team, individualism raising its ugly head again. What is individualism but self? Assertion. The assertion of the self to do it my way in Frank Sinatra's wonderful song. I did it my way. Right down to the grave, I did it my way. And what's he going to do in his way at the judgment? I don't know. But the problem here is always individualism. I want to do this, and I want to do it in my way. The insistence, for example, in a discussion, that this is the way I want to have it done. This is the only way that is right. Or if you don't like to go along with me, I do it my way anyway. I'll go ahead and do it all the same. I don't have to consider whether you like it or not, or whether you think it's good or not. I'm going to do it. And these are not talking about matters of doctrine. It's matters of how we conduct ourselves. Sometimes we have to let people go from the team. We have to ask them to leave, even, because the individualism makes teamwork impossible. Such people cannot associate and function properly in a team, because they are going to split the team before too long. They're going to insist on their way of doing things. I don't mean to say that we have no thoughts or ideas of our own. By all means, we should have thoughts, helpful suggestions, present them. It is rather difficult when somebody has no opinions on anything whatsoever. I mean, after all, when you have a co-worker, you want some feedback, you want some opinions, and you say, how about this way? Oh, that's okay. And how about the other way? That's okay too. This way? Okay, anything. Okay, I mean, it's okay to you. The question is, as far as the Lord's work is concerned, which is better? I'm not asking you which is better, and which you prefer. You see, the self can even be expressed in this no opinion position. Do you see that? One is simply, I don't care which in any way will do. The question is, that is not selflessness. Because if self has been denied, I am concerned about the Lord's interest. Therefore, I will consider which of these ways is best for the Lord's work. So don't think that when anything is okay for you, whether it's coffee or tea, I don't mind that either. That means most people don't care too much about that. But in many arrangements, if you have no suggestion to make, you may be opting out of your responsibility. And that isn't a sign that yourself is dead. It's simply that you're unconcerned about what is best for the Lord's work. Now, another sign, for example, and I'm speaking about signs which are very common among Christians, is the sign of moodiness. Moodiness is a sure mark that if you think you have denied yourself, then watch for that. Moodiness. You all know that. The guy's in good spirits one day, he's in bad spirits the next. What is moodiness? It's simply that you are focusing your attention on your inner feelings. That's what a moody person does. He does not look away from himself to the Lord. The Lord is always the same. Whether the weather is good or the weather is bad, what difference does that make to the Lord? Whether somebody has been nice to you, somebody... You see, a person who fixes his mind on the Lord, then fixes his heart on the Lord, he does not become moody. He fixes his attention, he is absorbed with the Lord. And therefore, he doesn't have to go up and down in these moods. Another sign of this failure to deny oneself, or the failure to put away self, is the lack of perception. This point worries me a lot. Paul says in 1 Corinthians, especially chapter 1 and chapter 2, that the spiritual things are spiritually discerned, and the carnal man cannot discern them. Many times in a conversation you see that the person you're speaking with has no spiritual perception, cannot discern the spiritual content of things at all, because the spiritual things are discerned spiritually. And unless you're spiritual, you cannot understand them, you cannot discern them. This comes out in preaching, this comes out in conversation, it comes out in leading Bible studies. You see that there is not perception there. And this is a great problem. Now, perception, of course, takes time to grow. But it will never grow at all unless the self has been put away. Now we must come quickly to this question of how to deal with the self. This is vital for us. Now, how to deal with the self, of course, is the problem that so many people have wrestled with and failed. This is the reason why we do not have the spiritual giants that the Lord has come to bring into being, his church. Now look again at this verse. If any man would come after me, let him deny himself, take up his cross. Now what take up the cross means, I shall expound in detail 2 Sundays from now, and follow me. Now, Clearly there is a negative and a positive here. Deny oneself is the negative side of things, take up the cross is the positive side. But we should not expound this aspect of the positive side. Rather, we shall expound this verse today in the light of Galatians chapter 2 and verse 20. Galatians chapter 2 and verse 20. And what do we read here in Galatians 2:20? This is another well-known verse, often quoted but not so often understood. I have been crucified with Christ. It is no longer I who live, but Christ who lives in me. And the life I now live in the flesh, I live by the faith in the Son of God, who loved me and gave himself for me. Now let us draw a number of points very quickly from this passage. First of all, we are talking about the very basics. I have been crucified. It's not something in the future, it's not something merely in the present, but it's something which for Paul is a reality already in the past. The perfect passive tense. I have been crucified with Christ. When he came to the Lord, he understood that the self had to go. He denied himself. You cannot be crucified with Christ unless you have denied yourself. You have come to an utter end of yourself. You have seen that the world's way of thinking is self-centered. But when you become a Christian, you turn your back on this whole way of thinking. Your whole attitude has to change completely. So at baptism, the whole meaning of baptism is that you died to Christ. But how many people, having been baptized, have really died with Christ, being crucified with him? If that were the truth, in the fullness of its application, there would be within you a power functioning now that will certainly exceed that of John the Baptist. The second thing we need to look at here right away is this. I have been crucified with Christ. It is no longer I who live, but Christ who lives in me. Not I, but Christ. Now, what does this mean? The first thing is clear to us is that so long as I live, Christ cannot live in me. Grasp this thing very clearly. If Christ could live within me without my having died, without my having been crucified with him, then why should I be crucified at all? You see, Paul is saying exactly the same thing as the Lord is saying here in Mark chapter 8, verse 34. Unless you deny yourself, you cannot follow me. Now, this puts us with a choice in this way. We have to choose either self or Christ, but we cannot choose both. If you do not deny yourself, you cannot follow me. If you follow me, you have to deny yourself. You either choose yourself or you choose me. That's exactly the same thing that the Lord that Paul is saying here. Only when I was crucified with Christ, that Christ can now live in me. The reason that Christ cannot live in us in his fullness is precisely because we have not denied ourselves. Christ has not been able to function in our lives. The reason for this is that Christ and us, in our carnal self, are totally disparate. They cannot come together. They cannot function side by side. In Chinese, they say, "Shi bu liang li." They cannot have these two forces side by side. My self, in my carnal nature, is the opposite of Christ. Therefore, if I am here, Christ cannot be here. If I am alive, then Christ cannot live in me. That's how it is. Now, are you perfectly sure? Are you perfectly sure that Christ lives in you? We use the term in Christ. Now, we cannot be in Christ unless Christ is in us. We can see that from John chapter 15. Paul uses the term to be in Christ, exactly deriving this from John chapter 15. I in you, you in me. These are two complementary truths. You cannot be in Christ unless Christ is in you. You see. Now, if Christ lives in me, in all his fullness, And Christ is greater than John the Baptist, and clearly I am greater than John the Baptist, because it is not I, but Christ who lives in me. I wonder how many of you, dear brothers and sisters, know the truth of Christ living in you. I wonder how many. If Christ lives in us, two things certainly will happen immediately. The first is that if he lives in me, then I will have a communion with him. I mean, if somebody lives in your house, what happens? Well, you will see him every day, you will talk with him, you will communicate with him. And if you are, yourself has gone, if you are totally unselfish, and the other person is totally unselfish, what sweetness of communion there will be. Do you recall, for those of you who are in love, why love between two young lovers is so sweet? I mean, in the early stages, until self starts appearing. This so-called falling in love at first sight, this is all very fine. It's all at first sight, there's no problem, because at first sight, self has had no time to assert itself yet, and it's very sweet at that stage. It's precisely because the two people have put the other person for the moment first. Ah, so sweet. But then, when each person starts asserting their self and their self-interest and their own ideas and insisting on their own ways, oh dear, then the trouble begins. Then the fighting begins. And when it comes to marriage, oh, everybody, the husband has so many ways, insist, this is the way it's got to be done. The wife says, no, this is my grandmother always did it this way, and that's the way I'm going to do it. And he says, no, my father did it this way, and that's the way I'm going to do it. And oh, they're at each other's necks, really fighting it out. You see, no fellowship can be sweet when self comes into it. Why is our fellowship with the Lord so poor, if we have any fellowship at all, that is? Because self is there. I'm always interested in myself. How can I commune with the Lord? And therefore, communion is gone, destroyed. Do you enjoy sweetness of communion with the Lord? Be very honest with yourself about this question. And let me say that if you do not enjoy sweetness of communion with the Lord, the answer is very easy to find. You have not denied self. He denied himself, but you haven't denied yourself. He denied himself to the point of death on the cross for us, for you, for me. But we haven't denied ourselves. And let me say as an absolute certainty that when you deny yourself, he will grant you the sweetness of communion with himself, such as you dare not imagine. Sweetness. Oh, how precious that is. Now, if you experience trouble in prayer, you will know in a moment's diagnosis that the self is fighting you every step of the way. You kneel down and immediately everything starts coming against you. The self rises up in protest. I haven't got time for this. I got so much homework to do, don't you understand? I can't spend time kneeling here talking to the Lord. I mean, that's fine in eternity. We'll do that when we get to eternity. Now we got to get on with the realities of everyday life. Oh yes, the self has so many ways, and you think, oh yeah, very reasonable. Yeah, I should be doing this. So bye-bye, Lord, and I'll see you another time. Maybe in eternity I will see you again. So, self opposes you, and you know that. Know that is the truth. Well then, what's the point of being a Christian if you don't want to live in the sweetness of this communion? Why not forget the whole business? It's either Christ or I. We have to choose one of these two things. If you want to choose the I, then do Christ the favor of saying, I am not a Christian and I don't intend to be a Christian. Fine. Because otherwise people think you're a Christian. And look at this kind of Christian. What's the point of it? You disgrace the name of the Lord. People don't want to become Christians because of you. A second thing, and we must close. If Christ lives in you, there will come a measure of power into your life that will soon become very obvious. You do not lose spiritual battles, you win them all the time. Do you always fail? Then clearly you have not denied self. Yourself has not been crucified. A Christian who fails constantly cannot be a victorious Christian. But Paul says he has made us to be more than conquerors. And this I have already explained before. More than conquerors, not just that barely enough to survive. It is enough superabundance. There is no contest in the battle because of the power that is functioning within us. He is living within us to will and to do of his good pleasure. And yet we cannot do his good pleasure all the time, because self is there. Now, as I said, we seem to understand what self-denial is. And yet in daily practice, self is there all the time. We must once and for all settle this question. If we don't once and for all settle this question, then we are not going to make it as his disciples. Would that Christ lives in us. But consider this final point. When you pray and God doesn't answer, you ask some more and he still doesn't answer. And you say, Lord, I've prayed about this 10 times already and you're still not answering. I mean, are you there or are you not there? The answer is he's there, but you're not there. That's the problem. What do we mean by we are not there? We are not there spiritually. We haven't come. We haven't arrived. The self is still dominating our lives. I would like you to remember one verse in James chapter 1 and verse 8 very clearly. James chapter 1 verse 8. Let not the double-minded man think that he will receive anything of the Lord. You will not receive anything. He told you this in advance. Don't ask why he didn't answer, because he already told you he won't answer. Because you're double-minded. What does double-minded mean? The most dangerous form of the Christian life is the kind in which we partly deny ourselves, partly acknowledge the Lordship of Christ, and yet partly we do not deny ourselves, and therefore partly do not acknowledge the Lordship of Christ. Now, either Christ is Lord or he is not Lord. This is something you must settle in your mind once and for all. Because if you pray and he doesn't answer, it's because self is still alive. You have not thoroughly denied it. Therefore, you are double-minded in your thinking. Therefore, God will not answer. And what's the consequence? Is if you keep on praying and he keeps on does not answering you, of course, what little so-called faith you have is going to disappear. It's going to go down the drain. God's reality comes to you how? Because you experience him working in your life. And how does he work? Because you pray and he answers. You pray again and he answers again. Oh, he is working all the time. And because he's working all the time, you see, I know God is real. I see him working. I experience his power. He is real. You can say with the Apostle Paul, I know whom I have believed. But can you say that? You pray, he doesn't answer. You pray again, he doesn't answer. He keeps on not answering. And then you say, God is not real. Of course God is real. Those of us who have put his truth to the test, have applied his teaching in our lives, we know he is real. I would not be standing here preaching these things if I had the slightest doubt in my mind that God is real. I should go doing something else, make myself a good living elsewhere. No. I speak because I know he's real, and I want you to experience that he is real. And I'm telling you the truth that God has said in his word, that unless you come single-minded to him, without self, totally finished with self, you will never experience his reality unless you do that. You have to make a choice between God and yourself, between Christ and the I. And this choice, I would say to you and urge you not to say, oh, I have made this long ago. You have made it? So I can see you as a spiritual giant, having sweet communion with the Lord Jesus, the fullness of his power coming through your life? Do I see this? If I do not see this, then I think you need to go back and examine whether indeed you have denied yourself. Let's be quiet before God in prayer.